Good afternoon, and welcome to our teleseminar on The Tale of Two Brains, Research versus Myth. We'll put an end to myths about how the brain learns. Old-school methodology for teaching and learning may have worked in the past, but technology and science provide us with new methodologies that allow us to be more effective teachers. Today, we'll look at unraveling some of the myths about how the brain learns and discovering how learning actually occurs. This is important. During the call, if you think of a question, please email us at questions@ahaprocess.com. Since we had about 100 people registered for this conference call, it gets a little too noisy if we leave everyone unmuted, and so as a result, we're going to go ahead and mute the conference call so Judy can speak unhindered. And so if you have questions, please, again, email me at questions@ahaprocess.com. Write that down if you think you might have a question. And then about 45 minutes, and I'll pose those questions to Judy when we get to our Q&A time. So I know when time is valuable. I'll go ahead and get right to introducing Judy. Judy Weber of not Yorktown, Indiana, but she's now living in California, has been a professional educator since 1986, teaching children in the classroom, training teachers in effective practice, and supporting low-performing schools as a mentor. Weber is a current board member of the Indiana Staff Development Council. And Judy, if any of this is wrong, please correct me when I finish. As an educational consultant for AHA Process since 2002, she served as a presenter, a mentor to schools engaged in the long-term implementation of Dr. McCain's A Framework for Understanding Poverty, and the coordinator of Dr. Payne's Trainer Certification Workshops. Weber is a trainer on brain research, primary source use in the classroom, and on the connection between the Earth's population, use of resources in the future. If you'd like any more information on what Judy's talking about today, please just email us or call us. You can find that information on our website at www.ahaprocess.com, and also Judy is available for consulting and workshops at your school and in your district. Again, if you have any questions during the call, please email them to me at questions@ahaprocess.com, and I'll pose those to Judy about 45 minutes after the hour when we get to our Q&A time. So without further ado, Judy, if you'd like to go ahead and get started.
Well, I'd like to welcome everybody to the teleseminar today, and we're going to be focusing on some myths and then also on learning and how the brain learns today. The first myth that I want to cover is called is one where we talk about IQ. Your IQ is fixed and it stays the same throughout your whole life. Another way this is often expressed is that the brain is static, unchanging, and set before you start school. What we know is that your IQ, or intelligence quotient, it's a score that's supposed to quantify your level of intelligence. What defines intelligence is still up for debate. So a high IQ isn't necessarily an accurate measurement. But it's long been assumed that our scores don't change, that we're stuck at the level of intelligence we were born with. And as you might have guessed, that's not true. In fact, many studies show changes in IQ just after a few weeks of effort. I'll give you one example. And in that example, 33 British students were given IQ tests and brain scans at ages 12 and 16, and then again about 4 years later by researchers at Wellcome Trust Center for Neuroimaging at the University of College London. And what they found was that 9% of the students showed a significant change of 15 points or more in IQ points. Now, these changes weren't just due to measuring errors. The MRIs that they used showed changes in gray matter, which are linked to IQ. Now, one reason this is good news is because it seems that having a high IQ is a good thing. What we know is that people with lower IQs, meaning in the 75 to 90 range, are more likely to wind up in prison, in poverty, or drop out of high school. There was another study conducted at the University of Delaware, and it asserts that higher IQ also has a correlation with higher social intelligence as well. So since IQs can change, these studies may not relate so much to people with higher scores, but rather hardworking, studious individuals or students who may struggle. Either way, there seems to be no harm in boosting your score, and there's really nothing barring one from doing so. Another widely accepted conclusion of current research in neuroscience is this idea of neuroplasticity. Our brains grow, change, and adapt at all times in our lives. And virtually anyone who studies the brain is astounded at how plastic it is. Kurt Fischer, who's an education professor and director of the Mind, Brain, and Education Program at Harvard University, says that the brain is remarkably plastic. Even in middle or old age, it's still adapting very actively to its environment. And also, according to neurologist and educator Judy Willis, neuroplasticity is defined as the selective organizing of connections between neurons in our brains. So what this means is when people repeatedly practice an activity or access a memory, their neural networks or groups of neurons will fire together, and that creates an electrochemical pathway, and that shapes themselves according to that activity or memory. So when people stop practicing something new, the brain will eventually eliminate or prune those connecting cells that form the pathways. This is sort of like a system of roads connecting a variety of cities. The more cars that go in a certain destination, the more lanes or the wider the road needs to be. And if you have fewer cars traveling that way, fewer lanes are needed. Neuroscientists have been talking that cells that fire together wire together since the late 1990s. That means if you perform a task or recall some information that causes different neurons to fire together, it strengthens the connections between those cells. So over time, these connections become thick, sort of like a roadmap that links various parts of the brain. And stimulating one neuron in the sequence is more likely to trigger the next one to fire. So practice makes permanent. The more times the network is stimulated, the stronger and more efficient it becomes. Now, one of the things that I want to do throughout this teleconference is connect this information on brain research to Dr. Payne's work on a framework for understanding poverty. And at this point, I can insert some of the work, and if we specifically look at resources, Dr. Payne identifies 9 resources that a student must have for school success. They are financial, emotional, mental, spiritual, physical, support systems, relationships and role models, knowledge of hidden rules, and the final one is formal register. And what we know is the more resources a student has available to him or her, the more likely he or she will be successful in school. If a student has 3 or less resources available, school success is often unattainable. So we're going to focus on mental resources, and that's defined by Dr. Payne as having the mental abilities and acquired skills such as reading, writing, and computing to deal with daily life. We have a quote from Reuben Feuerstein that really addresses mental resources in this way. He says, it's possible to have a brain and not have a mind. A brain is inherited and a mind is developed. So what does he mean by that? Well, what we know is that there are many students who come to school with either undeveloped or underdeveloped mental resources. It doesn't mean that the student can't learn. It just means that some students come to school with mediation skills and they're ready to learn, and other students come to school with no mediation skills and they seem to not be able to learn at all. But what we know is that students without mediation skills must have them taught by someone, and often that place becomes the school. So what are those mediation skills? It's really teaching the what, the why, and the how. And I know as a classroom teacher, I was pretty good at teaching the what. When I got involved with Dr. Payne's work, I began to realize that I often neglected the why and the how. A very simple explanation of a mediation skill would be don't cross the street, and that's the what, that's the information you're trying to get to the student, without looking both ways, and that's the how or the strategy that you want them to use the next time. And then the why would be because you might get run over. Now, a good example of these mediation skills, I have a friend who told me that recently she was at a grocery store and she saw a family and they were going through the checkout line and there are these 2 little boys and, you know, they're getting into candy and they're wrestling with each other and the mom got frustrated and she yelled at those 2 little boys, stop, and pointed at the wall in front of the cash register. And so those 2 little boys sort of threw themselves back on that wall, but nothing else was said. So in that situation, the children have not been mediated. They don't know anything that they should do differently next time. Basically, what happened is one word stopped the behavior. So the reason that's so important is that you might have another family where they come up to the cash register and they're checking out and there's three little children and they want, Mommy, Mommy, can we have some candy? And Mom starts saying something like this, no, we can't have candy because we're going to lunch at Grandma's house, and you know she gets upset if we don't want to eat when we get there. So what we want to do is we want to make sure that we're polite to Grandma and that we're ready to eat. Maybe another day we can have candy. And you can see that if we compare those two scenarios, in the first scenario, there was very little mediation that happened, just basically one word, stop. In the other example, there were lots and lots of words poured out to those children to give them the instruction they needed and how to make a different choice or come up with a strategy that they might be able to use another time in that same situation. And really, that's what happens in different families, that sometimes there's lots of mediation, and in other times, there's no mediation at all. So why don't parents mediate their children? If you have to have two or three jobs in order to provide for your family, you don't always have time to mediate your children. And in another sense, if you weren't mediated when you were growing up, it's not very likely that you're going to mediate your own children because you just don't, you can't really teach to your children what you don't know. So Dr. Payne also includes information on cognitive strategies from the work of Ruben Feuerstein. And cognitive strategies are what everyone's brain should know and be able to do. And there's three components within the cognitive strategies. There's the input strategies, which is the quantity and quality of data that a person is able to gather. Elaboration strategies are how efficiently a person uses the data that they gather. And then output strategies are how you communicate the information that you gather. Ruby often says that this is where shared learning occurs, or really should occur, but often that's not the case. Now, the issue with the input strategies, component of the cognitive strategies, is that as teachers, we expect students to come to school with input strategies intact. And often what happens is those children coming to school who struggle with learning have not had those input strategies taught to them. Now, the great news is that the input strategies can be taught. In the past, a student coming to school without mental resources eventually would be tested for special education, and the IQ that's measured without having those input strategies in place often become a permanent part of the student's record. If you believe in the brain myth, that the brain is static, unchanging, and set before you start school, the student is often labeled as having a learning disability, and the pace of instruction is often slowed because he or she can't learn. Dr. Payne says that these children can learn, and she gives us the strategies to teach them. Understanding the research on plasticity of the brain really shows us that all children can learn, that everyone has the ability to grow and change intellectually at any time in our lives. And I want you to think back to something I said earlier, and it was people with lower IQs, meaning in the 75 to 90 range, are more likely to wind up in prison, in poverty, or drop out of high school. So breaking this myth is important because we want everyone to know that IQ or that learning can change through the plasticity of the brain and the ability to form new neural pathways anytime in life. One example of plasticity that I like to share is to think about somebody who might have had a stroke. And plasticity is best understood when a part of the brain is damaged by the stroke. Let's say, for example, speech. But over time, the person regains his or her ability. New neural pathways in the brain take over the job of the damaged part of the brain. And the plasticity of the brain allows the person to regain speech, maybe sometimes very slowly, but the speech is gained. So I want to connect you now to what those cognitive strategies are. When I'm talking about the input strategies that we can often talk about as ready-to-learn skills that children often come to school without, I want to read and explain those cognitive strategies to you. The first one is using planning behaviors, and you might think about that as being able to set a goal and then accomplish the goal. You might think about it as being able to plan for a long-term assignment and complete it on time. You also might think about when you give a student, let's say, a math assignment, and the student, you give them 15 or 20 minutes to complete the assignment. And when it's time to start, they start writing on their paper. They don't like what they write. They ball up the paper. They break their pencil lead. They get up to sharpen their pencil. They throw the paper in the trash can, you know, like they're playing basketball. They go back to their seat, bumping books on the other student's table. And finally, they get ready to work. And within a few minutes, the time is completely up. And when you say time's up, they're just can't figure out what you're talking about because you didn't give them enough time. That's the piece about the planning behavior. The next input strategy is focus perception on a specific stimulus. That's really having the ability to focus on one thing and sort of let go of everything else that's going on. It's paying attention. The next one is controlling impulsivity. For me, when I thought about this one, I think about the behavior issues that I have in the classroom, but also if we think back to the planning behavior example that I just gave you, controlling impulsivity means that you can sit down and do your work immediately, that you can control all those other issues and be able to do what you need to do to be successful in the classroom. The next input strategy that Dr. Payne has in her work is explore data systematically. And that means that you have, if we took an example of having a paragraph to read and then maybe four questions to answer after that, if you don't have a way to examine or explore data systematically, you may look at different times that you have a paragraph and questions in different ways. What research tells us is that if you don't have a way to explore data systematically, you often lose about 60% of the information. So having a structured way to go through the content every single time, make sure that you're able to take a look at all of the data that's available to you, and it makes you be able to learn more of the information. Using appropriate and accurate labels is really about vocabulary. It's also about the content. If I don't have the words and I get very, very angry, how will I problem solve this issue, or how will I have a way to resolve conflict? If I don't have the words, I'm not going to be able to do that. So being able to have words that help you solve conflict and solve problems is an important component of behavior, which then facilitates academic learning as well. The next input strategy is organizing space using stable systems of reference, and that's really about spatial intelligence. I think the easiest way to describe it to you this telephone setting is to think about when kids are tested over objects and they give them one object and then there are three other examples and they want to know which one is flipped. And then on another one, they might want to know which way it's turned. That's just one way that we can look at organizing space using stable systems of reference. The next one is orient data in time. If we go back to the planning behavior where you give a student an assignment and we look at that child not being able to complete the assignment in the 15 or 20 minutes that you give them, often the issue is that they don't understand what 15 minutes are. Time doesn't have any meaning for them, and so they don't have an abstract understanding of time. Identify constancies across variations is the next input strategy. And basically, that's where you're able to look and see in a situation what stays the same, what changes, how things are like, how they're different, maybe doing the compare and contrast. The next one is gathering precise and accurate data. Let's say you're doing a math problem and you can't copy down the information appropriately. So if you can't gather the data and move it from paper into your head and then use the strategies you know to do the work that's given to you, you're not able to gather precise and accurate data. Considering two sources of information at once, that's definitely a compare and contrast. I'm looking at this, I'm looking at that. How are they alike? How are they different? Organizing data or parts to whole. If you don't understand parts to whole, you're going to have difficulty with fractions. And then the last one is visually transporting data, and this is actually one that one of my sons had difficulty with. And basically what he couldn't do is copy information off of the board and then follow up with the assignment. So, you know, it's an important one. And in part, Ruby talks a lot about kids who can't copy and so they can't cheat. And you know, sometimes that's a humorous one, but it's, again, an example of visually transporting data. So one thing that we can do to teach these cognitive strategies and to be willing to teach the cognitive strategies, one thing we can do is help students begin to think of their brain as a muscle that gets stronger over time or gets stronger with more use. Researchers now understand that IQ isn't fixed at birth. Just as we get more physically fit from exercise, we can build brain power through the act of learning. Now, Carol Dweck is a psychologist, and she says that children who adopt what she calls a growth mindset understand that intelligence isn't fixed, but it's developed through effort. And students who have this growth mindset are more willing to tackle challenges, learn from failure, and then see criticism as feedback rather than a reason to give up. This is the kind of thinking that keeps students motivated, even when learning is hard work. And I don't know about you, but have you ever had a student who wouldn't even try an assignment because they believed they couldn't do it? So that connection to motivation, I think, is an important one. So fostering this idea of a growth mindset that the more you work, the more your mind grows and changes. What we know is that mindset isn't fixed and that it can be learned and reinforced by the kind of classroom environment that you create, and then praise and high expectation as well. We can help students understand that challenging assignments will stretch their thinking muscles and at the same time provide them with the necessary support so they don't get discouraged. And looking at the mental resources component and also the cognitive strategies and input strategies from Dr. Payne's A Framework for Understanding Poverty are the support pieces that we need to teach in order to provide the students with what they need so they don't get discouraged. As humans, we've not really survived by taking in meaningless information. In order to survive, the brain is constantly attempting to make sense out of its environment. And the same thing is true about learning. If what students are attempting to learn makes no sense, their brain is going to have a great deal of difficulty manipulating, using, and storing that information. The more concrete the experience, the stronger the neural networks. Hands-on activities really provide students with this concrete learning experience. Unfortunately, concrete experience is not always possible, so what we can use as a mental model, which we use as a bridge to move students from the concrete to the abstract. We can also use that mental model to tap into the student's prior knowledge and help them understand new information. A mental model, as described in Dr. Payne's work, can be a two-dimensional drawing, a story, a metaphor, or an analogy. Now, earlier in this teleseminar, I talked about neuroplasticity, and it was defined as selective organizing of connections between neurons in our brain. So that means, again, that when you repeatedly practice an activity or access a memory, your neural networks, which are groups of neurons that fire together, create electrochemical pathways or shape themselves according to whatever activity you're doing or the memory that you're remembering. So it's important to remember that the brain does the work and builds the neuron connections. And so when we're working with children, we need to make sure that it's their brain that's doing the work and building the neural connections. Too often, as teachers, we do the work instead of the students. So here's some classroom strategies that get students to use their brain to form these neural networks. The first one is reciprocal teaching. An example of that would be, let's say that as a teacher, I'm working with an individual student, and we're reading an assignment. I might read a paragraph, and then the student would summarize that paragraph, and then the student would read a paragraph, and I would summarize. And basically what I'm doing is I'm modeling the reading, and I'm also modeling summarizing, which is one way to help the student develop these neural pathways. Another way would be a think-pair-share. After I teach a concept, students teach it to one another in pairs. Anytime we can use storytelling, what we know is the brain remembers stories. So anytime you can embed a story into your teaching, we can guarantee that it'll be remembered longer. Another strategy that I talked about earlier were the idea of mental models, tying new information to information that's been previously stored using either a two-dimensional drawing, a metaphor, or an analogy. All of those increase the probability that a student will understand and remember the information because it helps bridge the gap between concrete understanding and abstract understanding. The next strategy that you can use in the classroom would be something like a reflect and write, or what I typically call a quick write. And you can do this either in a content area like science or social studies where you teach a unit, and then you have the students write three sentences telling what they learned today. It's a quick way for teachers to determine who learned the concept, who did not, and then it's a way to be able to evaluate if you need to do some group work with students. Another way with writing would be to give students a sentence to complete. An example would be, something that was easy for me today was blank, or the most important thing I learned today was blank. And then if you have someone who struggles with writing, they only have to write a portion of what is there, but they're still getting that whole development of neural pathways through writing. Another component that's very important to remember is to emphasize concepts over individual facts. In today's world, the delivery of information, I mean, kids are just bombarded at a tremendous rate. So being able to recall isolated facts here and there is really not what we call an indication of a well-educated person. Only when we teach information within the context of a larger concept does it become used for life. So I'm going to move now from that myth to talking about emotion and learning and the brain. Now, there's a good amount of neurological evidence to promote the idea that if students do not feel comfortable in a classroom, they will not learn. Physiologically speaking, stressed brains are not able to form the necessary neural connections. Some of the strongest findings in neuroscience, findings that were suspected a long time ago but really have only been supported recently using functional magnetic resonance imaging, which is an MRI, and it tells us why that is. There are certain parts of the brain responsible for emotions. The amygdala, for example, processes emotions, stores the memories of emotional reactions, and reacts so aggressively to stress that it will physically prevent information from reaching the centers of the brain necessary for absorbing new knowledge. There's a study that was published in the Journal of Neurobiology of Learning and Memory in 2002, and it suggests that the amygdala is the part of the brain involved in mediating emotional arousal, and it has a strong impact on learning. Even feelings like embarrassment or boredom or frustration, not just fear, can make the brain enter that whole fight-or-flight mode. So therefore, it makes sense on many levels to create a learning atmosphere as much as focusing on the learning itself. What we know is reducing stress and establishing a positive emotional climate in the classroom is really the most essential component of teaching. The learner's emotional reaction to the outcome of his efforts really shapes the future behavior. In other words, if you have a student that doesn't believe a particular activity is interesting, relevant, or within the scope of his capabilities, probably not going to learn it. We also know that too much emotion can be as detrimental to learning as too little. Distractions and stress can also block receptivity to new ideas. And as educators, you know, we'd like to think we can overcome every stressor in a child's life. That's really not true. And so even though we can't overcome every stressor, we can think very seriously about how do I create an environment in my classroom where children feel emotionally and physically safe. The prefrontal cortex of the brain is the area for paying attention. It helps with calming and focusing, as well as it's also the area for short and long-term memory. And the student must be able to focus in order to connect with his or her memory. So earlier we talked about the whole idea of cognitive strategies, and in particular we talked about those input strategies. Let's focus on this piece of information, and I'll read through those input strategies again. This is the quote I want you to concentrate on. The prefrontal cortex of the brain is the area for paying attention, calming, and focusing, as well as the area for short and long-term memory. The student needs to focus in order to connect with his or her memory. So I want you to listen as I read through those input strategies, and you can see how in developing the input strategies or directly teaching those to the student, you'll also have them be developing areas in the prefrontal cortex. So using planning behavior, focus perception on a specific stimulus, control impulsivity, explore data systematically, use appropriate and accurate labels, organizing space using a stable system of reference, orient data and time, identify constancies across variation, gather precise and accurate data, consider two sources of information at once, organize data, and visually transporting data. What we know is that learning environments that keep students highly engaged, that foster community, family connection, and relationships, make the classroom environment more conducive to learning. Another piece would be to also understand the hidden rules of class and make sure that we're being very explicit and clear about what our expectations are. So we're going to connect reducing stress and establishing a positive emotional climate in the classroom is really the most important component of teaching to doctors' work on resources. If you know about the 9 resources, and you consider them as you're working to create this emotional climate in your classroom, you can also be developing both at the same time. Those resources, again, are financial, emotional, mental, spiritual, physical, support system, relationships and role models, knowledge of hidden rules, and formal register. And the more resources a student has available to him or her, the more likely he or she will be successful in school. If a student has 3 or less resources, school success is often unattainable. So we're going to look at about 5 of those resources, and we're going to think about them in terms of how will this help in creating this emotionally stable classroom. The first resource is emotional resources. And Dr. Payne defines that as being able to choose and control emotional responses, particularly to negative situations, without engaging in self-destructive behavior. So when something bad happens to you, you make good choices, and you don't abuse yourself or let anyone else abuse you. Emotional resources is an internal resource, and it shows itself through stamina, perseverance, and choice. Now, the reality is that the next resource, which is relationships and role models, is defined as having frequent access to adults who are appropriate, who are nurturing to the child, and who do not engage in self-destructive behavior. And I would add, and that they model the emotional resources so that the child has a place to learn appropriate behaviors in difficult situations. What we know about relationships and role models is that every child has those, but the issue would be to what extent can this adult in their life be nurturing and also provide a model for what healthy emotional resources look like. The next resource we're going to discuss is support systems, and that's having friends, family, and backup resources available in times of need. And these are all external resources. So if you have a child in your class who does not have support systems and you assign lots of homework or projects outside of class, in creating this emotionally safe classroom, you might think about how can I provide support systems within the context of the class so that the child does not perceive a threat every day when they have homework for every time we have a project and they don't have a support system outside the classroom to help them feel successful and to keep them from feeling panicked, which again really messes with their ability to learn. The next resource is a spiritual resource, and Dr. Payne defines that as believing in divine purpose and guidance, having hope, and knowing that tomorrow will be a better day. I like to think about children who I have had in my classroom who I know have had terrible things happen in their family, but every day they come to school, they have a smile on their face and they're ready for a new day. Spiritual resources also contains a component of having a future story. Again, if you connect that to the planning, use planning in our input strategies, you can see how those two together work together to really provide that spiritual resource. Knowledge of hidden rules. This is very important because children often bring hidden rules from the group they work with, and the definition of hidden rules is knowing the unspoken rules of a school, or it could be of your home life. It's really of any group. And what we know is that often children come to school and they don't know the hidden rules of school. So beginning to directly teach those hidden rules. And the other piece is being very respectful of the rules the children bring with them to school will also foster an emotionally safe classroom. What we want to remember is that if you have a student with less than three resources, the goal would be to create an intervention based on the resources the student has present. And by creating an emotionally safe learning environment, you can begin to build resources of your students, of all of your students at the same time. So knowing and understanding Dr. Payne's resources and the input strategies, if you consider those two pieces of information when beginning to think about how do I create an emotionally safe environment, it will give you the support you need and the children the support they need to be more successful in school. Another area that really connects to the idea of emotion and learning and the brain is the voices component of Dr. Payne's work. And it really fits into this idea of emotionally safe classroom environment. This component is based on the work of Eric Byrne, and he determined that each person has the capacity to use three voices. One voice is the child voice, and that's kind of a whining, a helpless voice. The next is a parent voice, and there's both a positive parent and a negative parent voice. This voice is usually a telling voice or a commanding voice, and the focus here is often to express an emotion. The positive parent voice is used to stop a dangerous behavior, such as running into the street. You wouldn't say to a kid running out in the street when a car was coming, "Stop, Billy." You know, what you'd say is "Stop," because you want immediate compliance. So the purpose of a positive parent voice is to stop something that might cause danger to a child. The negative parent voice would be maybe when a child says or does something that sends you right through the roof. You might say, "What is wrong with you?" or "What were you thinking?" Usually we point our finger and wave it up and down and get it in somebody's face, and sometimes we can lose control. The third voice is an adult voice, and it's an asking voice. Your tone is calm. You question, clarify, and seek to understand the problem. Your goal here is truly to resolve an issue, where with the negative parent voice, you always focus on an emotion, and in the adult voice, you move from the emotion to an issue. An example of an adult voice might be in a conflict. You might say something like, "What are your choices in this situation?" Now, one of the things we know about children is that if you were forced to become your own parent at a very young age, you tend to only have two of those three voices, the child voice and the negative parent voice. Now, what we know is this negative parent voice, it will stop a behavior, but it won't change a behavior. And in schools, our goal is always to change the behavior. And just in that example of the two little boys in the grocery store, when the mom said, "Stop," the behavior stopped. But that will not change a behavior. Only the adult voice will change a behavior. The adult voice also fosters relationship. If we connect this back to brain research that indicates that emotions impact learning, Take just a moment and jot down on a piece of paper, what impact do you think using the adult voice would have on a student's emotion, and what impact do you think the negative parent voice would have on a student's emotion? I'm going to give you about, 15 seconds. Well, brain research states that if someone perceives a threat, the brain goes into fight or flight. And when that happens, you cannot think or learn. It's all about survival. And the negative adult voice is a threat. The adult voice allows one to resolve conflict and still keep the relationship. Dr. James Comer says there's no significant learning without a significant relationship. The relationship does not have to be the parent. It can be anyone in the child's life. You need to have nurturing, and you need to have relationships for learning to occur. So implementation of the voices piece of Dr. Payne's work can have a significant impact on a classroom or school trying to create an emotionally safe classroom of mutual respect. Remember that if a threat is perceived, a response from the brain, fight or flight, or some kind of a stress response is activated. Now, this response is essential and can save your life, but the downside is that if you're in fight or flight, higher-level thinking processes aren't really that important. Emotions can either play a negative or positive role in learning. On the negative side, students who perceive a situation to be threatening, for example, being called on to answer a question or taking a time test, may find themselves in some degree of fight or flight, and then they're not able to recall the information, or sometimes they just can't think clearly. Classrooms must not only be physically safe, they must be psychologically safe as well. So some strategies that we might be able to use to create such an environment would be, an example would be, instead of calling on one student at a time, have students talk to each other in pairs and maybe answer the question. And you can walk around the room and monitor what the kids are saying, and then maybe have someone volunteer to answer. Another idea, and I did this in my classroom, and the kids were just so grateful. I had them do a speech on a paper that they wrote, and they were really scared about doing, a little bit of a presentation in front of the group. So I had them present to another person, and then the other person had to tell them how they did and maybe make some suggestions like talk louder or look at the audience. And they were so happy to have had that experience. So if you're going to have them do a presentation or a speech in front of the class, give them an opportunity to practice with a partner so that they have that opportunity to, have that rehearsal piece that we've talked about that helps to expand the student's learning. Another example would be give students a choice on how to complete a task and give them the ability to showcase their strength. So let's say you're having students do a book report. You might have a variety of ways they can deliver that, maybe as a skit, or maybe they could create a movie trailer, or they might just do it in normal written form. But the idea is that there are a variety of choices that give the students the confidence and the ability to showcase what they do best. Events associated with strong emotions, either positive or negative, are more memorable than ordinary events. That's why you remember your first kiss and not your 100th kiss. So I'm going to stop here and take some questions, and then we'll see how it goes.
Okay, so we had about half of the people on the line join after my little intro, so I'm afraid most of you didn't actually hear me say that we were going to have to mute the line since we had about 100 people registered. And the way you'd get questions into Judy was to email them to questions@ahaprocess.com. So if you've been thinking, oh, man, I wish I could ask Judy something as we've been going here for the last 45 minutes, go ahead and send those questions to questions@ahaprocess.com. I actually don't have any right now, so Judy, if you have another 5 or 10 minutes you'd like to speak to us about, maybe we'll see if we have any questions come in, and then we can end at that point.
Okay, I have a couple of, we'll see how far I get, but I have another myth that I think is very interesting, and it's also one that's been prevalent in today's educational world, and it's, are you left or right brain? So what we know is it's often difficult to sort through the information because there are lots and lots of materials out on being left or right brain. One popular thought has attributed certain learning styles and preferences to dominance of the left or right side of the brain. And it seems to explain observable differences among learners of left brain and right brain students. I'm hearing something. David, what is that? Is there something I need to attend to?
You know what? I didn't mute myself. That was probably my keyboard. I apologize. I'll mute myself.
No problem. There were some original studies that supported the theory. However, those studies involved severing, either through accident or surgery, the corpus callosum, was that band of nerve fibers that connects the two hemispheres. In a normal brain, the two sides of the brain operate together. But with the connection severed, the two halves cannot communicate. So this popular interpretation of the hemisphere explanation of personal learning styles ignored the complex interact reality of the two sides working together. While understanding the brain's hemispheres is undoubtedly relevant to education, children cannot be categorized as just left-brained or right-brained learners. The next myth I'm going to talk about is the one that says we only use 10% of your brain, and the reality is that we use our entire brain. But before I continue, I'm going to check with David to see if he has any questions.
Yeah, I mean, I've had two questions now, both regarding voices. The first one's from Jane Gray, and she asks, how would you frame using voices with pre-K teachers?
Well, I was a kindergarten teacher at one time, so in using that in the classroom, I'll tell you one thing that I did is I created a poster. Okay, David, I'm getting that feedback again.
Sorry.
I had a poster that I created that had the three voices on the poster, and we talked about it at circle time. And so what I would do is, let's say, for example, we had some kind of a issue out on the playground and, you know, kids were screaming and, you know, everybody saw the issue. And so I just brought it into circle time and I would say, which voice do you think, you know, after teaching the kids what those three voices are, say, which voice do you think the people who are fighting today used? Were they using the adult voice? Were they using the parent voice or the child voice? And then we just begin to identify it. The other thing that I would do is begin to teach words for feeling so that in that same case, when there's a fight, you might say to the child, what did you feel? And, you know, you might create a cluster of feeling words and have the child come up and pick the word, or if they can't read yet, you know, just begin to talk about, did you feel happy? You know, there's a poster that has all these different faces on it that identify emotions. Again, the idea of giving kids the language they need to be able to talk about conflicts really moves them from using their physicality to solve an issue versus using words to do that. Did that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, that's great. I have another question from Jeff Lavender, and he asked, why do teenage mothers only have the two voices?
Well, again, if you remember, I said that sometimes if from a very young age you had to start parenting yourself, you don't learn the adult voice. You only learn the child and the parent voice, and mostly because that's all you hear in your home. You know, I'm the victim, or sometimes I like to think about it, sometimes it's the victim and abuser voice. And so if I only have access to those two voices, I need to learn somewhere how to use that adult voice. I need to see it modeled. I need to have opportunities to practice it over and over again. I have a niece who was having a struggle with her ex-husband over their child, and I talked to her about the adult voice and how to use it in a situation with him to keep her voice calm all the time, to ask a lot of questions. And she said that it was the most effective thing she'd ever learned because they couldn't figure out why she wasn't getting mad and that she was so reasonable. And it just really messed with the interaction she was having with the other people. And they were able to come to a resolution eventually because she, you know, what we know is that when you have two people using the negative parent voice, there, that's an intensity, and the only thing it can do is accelerate. There's no way to move it from the emotion of what's going on to the issue. And with my niece, the issue was, how can we make decisions that are in the best, you know, the best interests of our son versus screaming at each other because one wanted to do it one way and one another way. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so that's all the questions we have right now. We've got about 5 minutes left if you've got one more thing you want to share with us, but if not, we can end here. It's up to you.
I think that this is a great place to end if you're okay with that.
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. So thanks, everyone, for joining us. Again, I want to remind you that Duty is available for consulting and workshops at your school and district. If you have any questions that you think of after the call ends, please go ahead and send them to that question at AHA Process, and I'll get them to either Duty or the appropriate person at the office to get those answered for you. We know your time is valuable, and we'd like to thank you for hanging out with us for 45 minutes, and thank you, Duty, very much for sharing that information. It was very interesting.
It was wonderful speaking with everyone. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, guys. I want to go ahead and close the call at this time, so until next time. Bye, Duty.